The following podcast is for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised. And welcome back, everybody. We're here at another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We're working through some sound changes.
Good Lord,
there it was.
Did it do it again?
Yeah, we can hear that.
Well, you still had granola bar in your teeth when you did the disclaimer, so I'm not the first person to make a weird sound today.
We're all hot mics today. We're, you know, you can hear all the squeaks, all the...
Yeah, that new board is making these mics work differently than they worked previously.
Did our old board just suck?
It must have.
Dang.
But it was the new thing when we got it.
Yeah.
Well, it looks exactly, the old one looks exactly like the new one from what I can tell with my glasses off sitting 3 feet away.
Yeah, I mean,
are there more buttons? Play one of the sound effects. Okay, not that one. What is that?
Wonk, wonk.
I never turned the music off in the background.
Crickets.
Okay. You'd think we would have used that by now. Not necessarily. I have a shout out.
Go ahead.
Oh, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist. I'm going to prove it today.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor.
I'm Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Shout outs where shout outs are due. Ethan Laney.
Oh, yeah.
Gets a shout out today. He reached out a couple of weeks ago on Facebook after Kelly's first part about the Allday family massacre and said that he was listening to True Crime on Easy Street to get him motivated for his final exam preparation.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad we can help you out, Ethan.
So, Ethan, we hope you made the Dean's List as opposed to failing miserably.
Keep us posted. I'm sure he did. Ethan is a very smart young man.
As long as he finished up somewhere in between the Dean's List and failing miserably, he gets a shout out either way.
Yep. Have no doubt. Way to go, Ethan.
Thank you for being
and,
a fan.
And War Eagle.
Oh, is he at Auburn? I didn't realize. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, good for you, Kelly Turner.
At my alma mater.
Yes. All right. So before we get started today, I've got to tell you guys about a recent trip that I took. It was my first ever trip to a Buc-ee's.
Oh, that's
Have you guys been to Buc-ee's before?
Business in the front, potty in the back.
You have been?
Yeah.
Yes, Katie? I've been to a Buc-ee's.
Okay, that was my first trip. We went to Birmingham a couple of weeks ago to see the Stallions play. And we took a trip out of the way. We went, got on I-20.
Yep.
Out towards Leeds. It's about 5 or 6 miles from downtown Birmingham to get to this Buc-ee's. And that was my first ever time. I mean, they're not a sponsor of the show, but they could be.
They could be.
So if you're out there listening, Buc-ee's general manager.
I love Buc-ee's.
Buc-ee's was founded in 1982 by a guy whose nickname was Beaver.
Oh.
So I think that explains the logo with the beaver with the baseball cap.
Yeah. What an unfortunate nickname, though.
Too bad about that.
Yeah.
50 locations, mostly in the South, some in the Midwest.
Yeah, that's the only people that would understand.
Yeah. And according to Wikipedia, the largest convenience store in the world is a Buc-ee's, and it is in Sevierville, Tennessee, which is close to Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg, that area.
It's giant.
And Buc-ee's is not a truck stop. If you didn't know that, trucks are not allowed at Buc-ee's. I didn't realize that until I read it afterwards.
It's not a truck stop.
It's not. But I mean, even the parking lot's huge. The building itself is ginormous. Is that a word?
Sure.
It is now.
How many gas tank, like gas
hundreds,
can't
things? 100.
What do you call those?
Gas pump.
Thank you. Hello.
Yeah. Right?
Whatever.
Well, it's early.
Let me drink some more coffee.
You're still digesting your granola bar.
And speaking of these mics, Scott, I think you can back off yours.
You're like busting my eardrums.
You're coming over the... That's better though.
I get that a lot.
Oh, that's
a lot of people tell me that.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. But
quiet down, Scott. I hear a lot.
Quiet down.
Yeah.
As far as Buc-ee's, though, I love the Buc-ee's, but I don't necessarily enjoy going all the time because it's a little much for me.
Yeah, I got my fill in about 15 minutes.
There's so many people there, and they are everywhere.
And it's kind of like the Panama City Walmart. You know, you only go if you have to.
Yeah.
Situation.
That is true. I will say this. I have had the brisket sandwich, the infamous brisket sandwich.
There was a line out the door for that.
It is.
When I was there.
Really delicious.
Okay.
And I just got it by default, actually.
I mean, you can get everything there.
Yeah, I've had a breakfast burrito there that was good.
Beef jerky, barbecue, ice cream, peanuts, t-shirts.
The beaver
Beaver Nuggets.
The Beaver Nuggets, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people get those. I've never had them.
They're good.
Apparently, there's some ridiculously spicy stuff you can get there that Travis, Shorty West, his oldest son, Trey, loves. He loves hot things.
So like and pepper jelly, because I got some of that.
It's not pepper jelly. It's something that you eat, and he could just eat it and not be bothered, and everybody else was about to die.
If you've never been to a Buc-ee's, just imagine that you had a Sam's Club in one hand. And a Cracker Barrel restaurant in the other, and you jam them together. That is a Buc-ee's. And you threw in some gas pumps on the outside.
They do. They sell clothes. You can buy a Buc-ee's bathing suit.
Yes.
You can buy a Buc-ee's button-up shirt if you're going somewhere nice.
It didn't bother me so much the little kids standing in line to have their picture made with the guy in the Buc-ee's suit.
I gotcha.
But really, the adult human beings?
That's ridiculous.
Come on, man.
Come on.
Is that what you're going to put on your Facebook
page? It's going to be all over their social media. It's it's going to be their new Facebook photo, main photo, profile pic.
Save that story for one drunk night around a campfire. Don't post it on Facebook. I promise I'm going to tie this Buc-ee's trip of mine into today's true crime
story.
Well,
what all did you buy? You said you bought pepper jelly.
I got pepper jelly and those nuggets, the Buc-ee's nuggets, whatever they're called. And it's just kind of like a imagine a Cheeto, except that it's been dipped in sugar instead of cheese.
Oh, they're all sweet? All the nuggets are sweet?
It's kind of a caramel flavor.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
Pretty good. We ate them all on the way to the game.
Did you, didn't get some jerky from the wall of jerky?
I got some free jerky samples because they're just standing there. They're basically throwing it at you. Hey, come try this.
And if so you, there's somewhere posted where the salaries of the different various...
Apparently, they're paid pretty well.
They are.
And they're everywhere. I mean, there are as many employees in the store as there are customers. Well, maybe not quite as many. Mm-hmm. But they have registers at every door. Mm-hmm. So there's no long line like when you go to the grocery store or, God forbid, Walmart.
I know.
And you're just waiting for
your
turn.
Why have 50 cash registers and not open all of them?
Yeah.
Well, there are two Walmart stores now that are doing completely away with their self-checkout. As like a model. So I think that's probably what we're going to...
It's a good start.
Well, I think it's, you know, a test run.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm a fan of the self-checkout. Mm-hmm. I dig it a lot.
Me too, most of the time, because I usually have four things. I mean, I've got cat food and batteries and flypaper and, I don't know, something
maybe
weird.
A new remote cover.
Something weird. Something that doesn't match with the other three. You know, a broom.
Yeah.
And then no way to get the broom home because my car trunk is tiny.
Got to put the top down.
with a broom handle sticking out of the back.
There you go. Yeah. So, yeah, Buc-ee's. Interesting. I have a Buc-ee's Halloween shirt.
I didn't know that they themed their shirts to match the holidays.
Of course they love.
Yeah, I guess right.
I love Halloween. Mm-hmm. It is my favorite time of the year.
You've already got your skeleton outside, I noticed, when I drove past your house the other day. And it's
and
May.
He will stay there forever. He's part of my life. Just kidding. No, I love their Halloween shirt. It's fantastic.
I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that it is orange in color.
Black.
Oh, okay. Even better. Okay. Mm-hmm. Orange on it anywhere?
A little bit. Yeah.
Just enough that you know it's Halloween.
It's like a foggy full moon night at Buc-ee's.
Okay.
You know how you have the big full moon and then the little cloud is like right in, kind of in front of it. Like the
creepy
spooky
tree on one edge and the old house on the other.
Now, it's fantastic.
Is Buc-ee's 24/7?
I don't know. Good question.
It was middle of the day when we were there.
Yeah, I've never been at night.
So. I don't know.
So I don't know.
Line out the door.
It is crazy for the, and I will say, the brisket was delicious. Mm-hmm. Would I wait in that long of a line for it? No.
Okay.
It was just by happenstance. There wasn't a line.
I thought there was a butt coming.
Able to get the brisket.
Right.
I enjoyed it. Was happy I bought it. Wouldn't wait that long for it.
Okay. You guys ready for this?
I don't know. No, are we?
I'm not ready. You've already seen the title.
Yeah.
So you know what it is.
We've and if you run the disclaimer.
If you don't exactly, please pay attention to the disclaimer.
Yeah.
If we go to
I'm not gonna go nuts.
Yeah. Well, but if we go to the trouble to put that on here, please pay attention to
that. That means we're concerned.
Yeah.
That means we don't want to hear this either.
Exactly. Usually.
But
we
want you to want to hear it.
If you know the story, you're geared up. You've probably seen documentaries, you've probably watched everything you can. You've probably listened to podcasts. If you don't know this story, you know, we're going to give you the 101 and we're not going to, you know, I don't know how far down rabbit holes you're going to go, Scott, because you can go down a
lot. There are, like with a lot of the stories that we tell, this is pockmarked with rabbit holes.
Absolutely.
Before we begin telling you the story itself, let's tell you a little bit about where today's true crime story took place.
Okay.
West Memphis, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. It's in the northeast corner of the state of Arkansas. There's about 25,000 people who live there. It is across the Mississippi River from Memphis, Tennessee. It is considered part of the Memphis metropolitan area.
The Memphis, Tennessee metropolitan area? That's weird.
Oh, wow. I did not realize.
Find West Memphis on a map, and you'll see that this is a spot. It's in middle America where two major interstates converge and run concurrently for a few miles.
Okay.
I-40 is the east and west corridor that goes from North Carolina all the way to California.
Wow.
I-55 runs north and south and connects Chicago and New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
And right here in West Memphis, Arkansas, they converge for a few miles.
Oh, my goodness.
For truckers, cross-country travelers, West Memphis is a place to crash for the night, grab a bite to eat at one of the many fast food places that line both sides of the interstate in this area, or fuel up for the next few hundred miles for your trip to wherever the hell you're going. There are access roads that run parallel to the interstate to allow access for the people who live in the neighborhood to get to where they need to go without getting on the interstate. And then there's an overpass that connects both of those access roads. Economy motels, fast food joints, like I said, a bunch of gas stations, and a bunch of truck stops. Not Bucky's gigantic, but big truck stops.
And you said Bucky's isn't a truck stop.
It is not a truck stop.
So,
but these are Bucky-sized locations for 18-wheelers.
Gotcha.
And I told you all of that to tell you this. 2 years after the tragic events that we're going to talk about today, I was in West Memphis, Arkansas, at one of those truck stops. At the time, I worked in Tuscaloosa for a company that made a magazine, a monthly magazine that was geared to appeal to the over-the-road truck driving community. It was called Truckers USA. It has gone out of business. I had nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like you wouldn't want to read a magazine while driving a truck.
Yeah. Well, you know, it takes a minute to fuel up.
So they could read it.
So you've got time to flip through the pages.
Well, yeah.
I meant to bring you guys a copy. I actually still have one.
Do you now?
I'll bring it next time.
That doesn't shock me that you still have a copy.
Wow. Well,
I wrote an article in that month's issue about Richard Petty, so.
Of course you did.
Of course I did.
Yep.
Now, the magazine, which, like I said, has since gone out of business, but we were invited to this truck stop in West Memphis, Arkansas, some of our publishing team, to a two-day fundraising event for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is located in Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, way to go, Scott. Yeah.
I think they had to drag me kicking and screaming, but I was there.
Well, then just pull that rug right out from under me.
Sorry. And if you don't know about St. Jude, that's where they treat terminally ill children.
Yes, and the parents never have to pay.
Yeah.
And they have to stay. You know, there's always someone who has to be with the child.
Yeah, we're talking life-threatening conditions, brain tumors, cancer. That's what St. Jude does.
And St. Jude is not a sponsor, but they never have to be.
They
we will always promote them.
That is right. So this was a two-day event at this truck stop. And that's where I first heard about the West Memphis Three. I'd never heard of them before. The story happened 2 years before, and it was all over the news. But in May of 1993, I was in college having a good time, and I was not paying attention to the news. What I'm telling you is that before I was a mediocre journalist, I was a mediocre follower of journalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't remember this, and I'm old enough I should have remembered this, but I don't know why I didn't know anything about it, but did this happen in 93?
May the 6th, 1993. May the 5th, 1993.
May the 5th, 1993. So
that was the day the kids went missing. They found them the next day.
The next day. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I was about to be in high school.
Right. So. Well, so I'm standing at the truck stop and somebody there, somebody that's helping us set up our tent or somebody who's come by to visit with us says, hey, that patch of woods right over there, that's where they found those three boys 2 years ago.
Oh.
It's the first time I'd heard of it. Now, some people will tell you that the case of those three murdered little boys has long since been solved. And a lot of other people will tell you that there were actually six victims of this crime. In fact, the term West Memphis Three doesn't even refer to the three little boys who were murdered.
Which is so disheartening to me.
It refers to the three teenagers who were convicted of the murders. This is one of the most complicated stories we have ever tried to tell. That's why we're going to do it in three parts. Try to do it. Emphasis on try.
Well, and you can listen to podcasts who have devoted their entire podcast to this.
Season. Seasons, plural.
Yeah. But you can go do that. Listen to the 101 here with us first, and then dive deeper if you want to.
So here we go. We're beginning West Memphis, May, 31 years ago this month, as you listen at home. On Thursday, May the 6th, 1993, just as I was getting ready to graduate from college, and thus not paying attention to the news, three second graders, all eight-year-old boys, were found murdered in that wooded area that I just mentioned, adjacent to this truck stop in West Memphis, Arkansas. The summer after I took that trip and heard about this story for the first time, in 1996, there was a documentary that appeared on HBO. It was called Paradise Lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was in the summer of 96, 3 years after the crime, 2 years after the trials, 1 year after I was in this area.
I recommend that documentary to go and watch it.
I've watched it twice this week. And it was just as hard to watch those two times as it was the first time.
Yeah.
Among other reasons, because the very first minute of the film, you see these gruesome crime scene photos.
Mm-hmm.
Just right off the bat. You're already
freaked
out.
It's mature audiences.
And nobody has said a word yet.
Yeah.
In this documentary. Another reason that this movie was in the news at the time, other than the obvious reason, is because it was the first time ever that the heavy metal band Metallica had agreed to allow their music to be used in a film of any kind. And just to warn you, if you like heavy metal music, you're going to hate this fucking story before it's over. And the movie also garnered a lot of attention because it seemed to a lot of people that three dirt poor children who could not afford decent attorneys had been railroaded by the justice system in the state of Arkansas. That's what a lot of people thought. I'm not saying that that's what I believe. I'm going to try not to tip my hat or show you my cards. I don't want you to know what I think. We're just going to try and lay out the facts as best we can and let our listeners decide for themselves. Don't rest on our laurels. Determine your own when it comes to this story. Listen to another podcast, like Katie said, or like Kelly said. Listen to another podcast. Do some research. Plenty of books that will explain it to you either way.
Sure.
Books by the dozens. We're going to come to a point in the story where there is a conclusion that is reached that everybody can live with. But that very same conclusion is going to make you want to go home and take a bath with your toaster.
Yeah, it's so frustrating.
That felt like too much, was it?
You know.
With the toaster.
Probably a little much.
Let's probably not.
I don't even have a toaster anymore.
Can we back that up and say something different? Okay.
Moving along.
Yeah, whatever.
That's a topic for the third episode.
Conclusion. It's very frustrating.
That we can all
live
with.
Quote, conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you not use a toaster anymore?
It's you know, you gave me the air fryer that you guys don't use.
Yeah.
And so I have figured out a way to make toast in the air fryer. You just have to put something on top of it so that it doesn't blow around.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have a circle of untoasted bread in the middle.
I make toast in my oven.
I do like toast in the oven now that I've said that. My grandmother used to would make toast in the oven. So
my grandmother did the same. My grandmother didn't have a toaster. So if we wanted toasted bread, it got
your oven
toasted.
Will do all of that. Yeah. Don't take up space with a toaster.
Yeah. So, like I said, that's the conclusion is a topic for episode 3. Today is episode 1. So let's get started with episode 1. Let's focus first. Here's the bad part.
We got to hear what happened.
Let's do the crime scene.
Right.
The three little boys who were murdered, Stephen Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore, they were last seen together on the evening of Wednesday, May the 5th, 1993. All three boys were walking together down the street, two of them on bicycles, the other holding a skateboard. The three were walking together through the neighborhood, this working class neighborhood where they lived, headed towards this wooded area that I mentioned.
And they are all 8?
They're all 8 years old.
Okay.
It was around 6:30 p.m. when they were last seen. So it was still daylight at the time because the sun set at 7:49 that night.
Yeah. Much like in Alabama right now.
Right now.
Daylight is longer.
8 minutes before the sunset, the moon rose on the other side of the horizon. And there was a full moon that night.
So bright.
And as journalist Mara Leverett wrote in her 2002 book, Devil's Knot, which I will mention several times today, and I have read, in the absence of other suspects in the murders, at one point, the moon itself became a suspect in this case. I'll explain that when we get there.
Oh, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So the three little boys, they were friends. They all attended Weaver Elementary together. Two of them were in the Boy Scouts together. One of them, Michael Moore, wore his Boy Scout uniform almost every day. Every chance he got, his little shirt and his hat, he was wearing it that day. And just like a lot of kids did back then before the internet, before everybody had a video game and a TV in their bedroom, you rode your bike. I did. A decade before this, that's what I did until Mom shouted, come home when the streetlight comes on. Literally. Yep. And that's what these boys were doing that day. It was a Wednesday. The next day, It was a Wednesday, so they were headed towards the weekend. But every day after they finished their homework, you go outside and you play with your friends until the streetlight comes on. Let's tell you a little bit about the three boys. Christopher Byers, his parents had divorced when he was 4 years old. He lived with his mother and his adoptive stepfather, a hulk of a man named John Mark Byers. We're not through talking about that guy. Stevie Branch was also the product of a broken home. He lived with his mother, Pam, and his stepfather, a man named Terry Hobbs. His name's going to come up again. Stevie's mother and stepfather were the primary focus of a 2013 film titled The Devil's Knot, after Mara Leverett's book, that starred Reese Witherspoon. I'd never heard of the movie before I watched it this week. Colin Firth is in it, trying his best to sound like he is from Arkansas instead of England. And he is...
Sometimes they can make that change.
Colin Firth did not.
He's a little too proper,
He's
probably.
A little too proper. Great actor. Mm-hmm. Horribly miscast in this role, I thought.
Well, maybe it's just from being from the South. I find it hard to listen to a fake Southern accent.
Yeah. Well...
Same.
And that's what makes it... That's what Reese Witherspoon, she's from Georgia.
Yeah.
She's not faking it.
No.
She's faking it when she doesn't sound like us.
Yes.
So she nailed it.
I'm sure.
But Colin Firth, not so much. Michael Moore, the third little boy, he was the son of Todd and Dana Moore. Todd was a truck driver. He was gone when this happened on the road. He was considered the leader of the three boys, so to speak. Like I said, he's in the Cub Scouts, wears his cap all the time. And so the three boys did not show up for dinner when the streetlights went out on Wednesday, May the 5th, 1993. When they didn't come home, Christopher Byers' stepfather, John Mark Byers, he was the first person to call the police about 8 o'clock, reported the boy missing.
And you said earlier he had adopted the little boy.
There is some conjecture about whether or not he had. The boy's real father says he never gave up the rights to his son, and you're not supposed to be able to adopt someone
if they
already have a father and they haven't given up their rights. So there's some dispute about that.
Oh, okay.
But John Mark Byers always said he had adopted Christopher.
He saw him as his own.
Nobody has seen the paperwork. But yeah, for whatever reason.
They had the same last name.
Well, but he changed his last name. He changed Christopher's last name when he adopted him, and I'm doing air quotes.
Okay, gotcha.
So the city's police department made what I think would be called a cursory search of the area that night.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the parents got involved, and a lot of them headed to this four-acre patch of woods called Robin Hood Hills. The parents called it Robin Hood Hills. The kids just called it Robin Hood. Let's go to Robin Hood.
Okay.
That meant let's go play in the woods. Imagine being the mother of one of these three boys, and you have to go to bed or try to sleep on Wednesday night, May the 5th, and your little boy's not in his bed down the hall.
I think I would have just stayed in the woods.
They didn't go to sleep that night. Yeah, I wouldn't have.
I think I would have wandered around the woods.
That's the first nightmare in this story. Actually, and there's going to be plenty more nightmares before we're finished, but actually it's the second nightmare in this story because the parents don't know about the first nightmare yet. They don't find out about that until 2 o'clock the next day.
Yeah.
It turns out that the first nightmare was what happened to those three little boys. The next afternoon, in that area of Robin Hood Hills, most of the officers had already left that area. They had gone on to search in other places because they hadn't seen a single thing that indicated to them that the boys had been there. And then one juvenile probation officer who had stuck around to search a little bit longer found a shoe floating in the water. One little boy's sneaker. That search led to the discovery of the three bodies in this waist-deep ditch in this wooded area. There was a drainage canal that had been built several years before. It was a man-made drainage canal that ran adjacent to the interstate, parallel to the interstate, because this close to the Mississippi River, there are dikes built between populated areas and the river, so when the river floods, it doesn't flood the town. But that created a situation in West Memphis where rainwater couldn't wash as it normally would down into the Mississippi because of this dike. So they built this big drainage ditch to drain the rain out of the area, and they go downstream far enough that there's a break in the dike and it can drain into the Mississippi River. And so there were areas that had built up over the years where rainwater collected and drained into this canal, and this was one of those ditches. So it was 4 or 5 feet wide, 2 or 3 feet deep, but it's just deep enough that you can tie up a little boy and drop him in the middle of it, and nobody will see him, or three of them. So they found Michael. He was the first one. The guy reached into the water, had to climb into the water to get to this shoe, and when he did, his leg brushed up against what turned out to be the body of Michael Moore, floated to the top. Then they found Stevie a little bit further down, and then they found Christopher a little bit further down. All three boys were naked. They had been tied in this very strange fashion, left ankle to left wrist, right ankle to right wrist, behind their backs. So they were stripped naked, laid down on their stomach, and tied with their own shoelaces. The shoes that they found had no shoelaces on them because they were on the boys. Later that afternoon, the police found the two bicycles about 50 yards away. They had been thrown into the water. An hour later, somebody thought, hey, we should call the coroner. This is going to create problems later in determining the exact time of death, because the three little boys laid on the bank for a couple of hours in the sun. Insects.
Yeah.
Became hard to determine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other details about the crime scene include these facts. All of the clothing items were found except for one sock and two pairs of underwear. All three of the boys' pants had been pulled off with the zippers and buttons still attached, still engaged. Two of the pairs of pants were inside out. I mean, somebody grabbed these pants and just literally jerked them off these boys.
Sounds like from the waist.
From the waist, off. Just jerked them off.
Usually, you know, a little boy doesn't have any hips. Like
True.
They keep their pants buttoned and, you know.
Yeah. And if it's inside out, you got to pull down. Just
ripped right off. Yeah. So basically what happened is this. The three little boys were knocked unconscious. They were all hit over the head. They all had head injuries of varying degrees. They were stripped naked, tied up with their own shoelaces. Stevie and Michael were tossed into the ditch to drown. Christopher was subdued and then sexually mutilated. And then tossed into the ditch. That's why we ran the disclaimer. So we're past it now. Prosecution, one more sentence. Prosecution experts would later claim that the wounds to Christopher were the results of a knife attack, that had been intentionally done to him. That's the official version of the story. Store that in a cool, dry place. You're going to need it later. The West Memphis Police Department, I believe it is safe to say, was overwhelmed by the magnitude of this case. The entire city was in shock. Newspapers and TV journalists from all over Arkansas and all over the country flocked to West Memphis, Arkansas, and began competing for breaking stories about the details of the boys' murders. John Mark Byers, that hulking 6'5", 250-pound stepfather of Christopher Byers, was the parent most willing to talk to anybody who would stick a camera in his face. You can see it in Paradise Lost. He can't wait to talk. Within a week of the murders, with no suspects in sight, the West Memphis police had publicly announced their willingness to entertain the idea that, quote, gang or cult activity had something to do with the crime. They have no evidence of this, but that's their theory after 4 days.
Well, something this horrible happens, you want to make it make sense. Yeah. You want it to...
You'd want it to, in a sense, yes, make sense, and in a sense, not make sense, because what rational person...
Yes.
We're looking for a crazy person.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and in a sense, I mean, you are looking for a monster, mm-hmm. but just... not someone involved in the occult.
Well, yes. I mean, it seemed like a strange prognostication of the outcome so soon after the discovery of the bodies. I thought you were going to drop your coffee mug right off the edge of that table. I didn't think you were going to make it. But she did.
I'm a pro.
If you hear a crashing sound, it's because of something on the board. It's not because of that coffee mug. Okay, so this seed has been planted, right? 4 days in. Within hours of the discovery of the bodies, there are already rumors circulating around town that Satanism had something to do with the crime.
Yeah.
Is this in the middle of like the satanic panic?
Yes. Yeah.
We were in the early 90s.
I'll get to that in just a minute. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. The West Memphis police, when they assigned a number to this case, the number they assigned was 93-05, May of 93. -0666.
Oh, good gracious.
They claimed to reporters who asked that that was a coincidence, but years later, it would be discovered that the original case number had been 0555, not 0666. It turns out the West Memphis police had been presented with what is known in law enforcement circles as a blank crime scene. This area of Robin Hood Hills. No physical evidence. Nothing.
And you got water involved.
Yeah.
It's always a...
That's right.
Water is a booger.
So what the police... people will tell you who think the West Memphis Three are innocent. They will say the police devised their own theory about this crime and then tried to figure out why. They thought they knew why. Now they had to figure out who fit the why.
And this is 101 of what you should not do in any scenario of life. Anything.
No. Never assume anything. But that's what the West Memphis police did. And if you think you're frustrated now.
I know. I got to calm down. Already.
Keep listening to this story, which will continue right after these words from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you in part by A&W Outdoor Services, located right here in Cherokee County, Alabama. It's almost time to tidy up the deck, clean the gutters, and spruce up the yard and landscaping around your home, lake house, or creekside cabin. And who better to do that for you than the professional crew at A&W Outdoor Services? Call 256-706-7964 and let Alan and his crew do all the hard work for you so you can spend your time this summer enjoying your piece of Cherokee County in clean, carefree comfort. Call Alan today for a free estimate or to get on the A&W spring schedule before it's full. That's A&W Outdoor Services at 256-706-7964.
Hey guys, do you know what time it is?
Tell us!
It's time to plan your best vacation ever, right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best year-round at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a days-long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Thank you to all of our wonderful sponsors. Scott, I'd say, you know, where are we going from here, but I'm afraid.
I hope I know.
Yeah, you do. You got this.
All right. So as we mentioned, the cops in West Memphis, Arkansas, were pivoting to a prevailing belief that Satanism, the occult, witchcraft, something like that, could somehow explain this baffling crime scene.
Sure. Scott.
Go ahead.
How big is this police department?
I think there are 15 detectives on the in the department.
So it's not too small.
They're all working on this case.
It's not too small, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know. No,
it's not triple murder.
They're not experienced.
If you're not talking New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago or some of the big cities.
Big metropolitan area.
Where this is an everyday occurrence.
Yeah.
This is not an everyday occurrence. In fact, it was so strange for this part of Northeast Arkansas that the governor of the state of Arkansas, Jim Guy Tucker, who had replaced recently elected Bill Clinton as president, as governor of Arkansas, he offered the assistance of the Arkansas State Police.
As he should have.
And on that note, one leading theory about why the West Memphis police declined the governor's offer of assistance was that the department itself, along with several officers from the Crittenden County Sheriff's Office, were under criminal investigation by the Arkansas State Police. It had been for 4 months when the murders took place.
Well, just way to go, guys. I mean, let your own...
Drugs.
I'm going to shut up.
Drugs and guns.
You guys are fantastic.
Wait, are you saying this is true? This they were under investigation?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. They absolutely were. Yeah.
Okay. That is not a matter of
conjecture. They were horrible people.
Drugs and
criminals. Criminals is what they were.
Yeah, drugs and guns had been seized at various arrests by this combined drug task force. Some police officers, some members of the sheriff's department combined to form this drug task force.
And let me be clear, not all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Not all of them.
At least at the time of the murders, evidence had come up missing from the evidence lockers.
Are they selling this? Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They're selling the drugs and the guns.
Gotcha.
And making money. At least 14 officers had been interviewed already by the Arkansas State Police when the murders happened on May the 5th.
So their own crap is getting in the way of trying to solve a triple murder of 8-year-olds.
And this story was something that the public at large had no idea, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I'm definitely
a secret investigation.
In hindsight, yeah, for sure.
So on top of all of the other layers that we've peeled back so far, throw that one on top of the pile.
I don't understand why they were even given the option. I mean, if you're being investigated, should you get that option?
I hear you.
But I guess that's the law, or is that a rule?
I guess whatever the investigating department is in charge of the investigation.
I guess it would have to just be the law, right? Yeah. But maybe we should have a different law where if you're currently being investigated.
That sounds good to me.
For things that we are proving that you are doing,
that
you should probably not get a choice. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
You guys remember last March when we talked about the boys on the tracks?
Yes.
From 1987.
Also in Arkansas.
Also in Arkansas. So you're beginning to see that law enforcement in Arkansas was corrupt.
I don't want to get murdered in Arkansas because they're not going to know who did it.
I don't want to get pulled over for speeding in Arkansas.
I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. We're several years removed from all of this.
This is 31 years ago. But just another sign of more of what we talked about when we talked about the boys on the tracks. I mean, the cops involved in criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when all of this happened, the same prosecutor who ended up prosecuting the three teenagers decided not to prosecute any of the law enforcement officers who had been under investigation. Hey, we can't be dealing with that situation while we're dealing with this triple murder case. So I'm just throwing all of this out.
That's going to look bad.
Garbage can on all of this stuff. Round file.
That's going to look bad.
Guys, if this story is a 20 aisle supermarket, we're on aisle one with our buggy right now. It's going to be a long time before these groceries get out to the car.
And the groceries are crap. All the groceries are crap.
And the groceries. all the fruit's spoiled. Eggs are cracked.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And you've probably started a debate by using the word buggy.
Oh, yeah. Shopping cart. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not correcting you. That's what
I meant to say shopping cart, damn it. And I said buggy instead.
It's a buggy.
It's a buggy to me.
Yeah. It's a buggy in Arkansas. I bet you, too.
I'll bet it is. So that's one theory about why the local police did not want the state police involved.
Makes sense.
They already had their theory. They knew what happened.
Satanism.
We've got this. It's Satanism. It's devil worshipers. It's the cult. It's the occult.
Oh, the old Satan worshipers cult strikes again.
Yep.
That are everywhere.
They were very active in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm just going to tell you.
And the prosecution team figured that this story of Satanism would be in the absence of any other theory. No evidence.
Mm-mm. There was no symbol, or there was nothing like Hail Satan, or no evidence of any kind of like carvings on their body that was a Satan rules, or you know, the devil is cool. Mm-mm. Nothing like that at the scene.
No.
Okay. Just checking.
But the prosecution and the cops are thinking, you know what? This is going to be a pretty easy sell, this Satanism thing. An extremely conservative, devoutly religious.
Yeah.
West Memphis, Arkansas.
Bible Belt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why people who think the West Memphis Three are innocent will tell you what they tell you. And we're going to lay out the facts. We're going to let our listeners make up their own minds about what you think happened. All right, back to the story. 2 weeks after the crime, much of the investigation was, and I'm quoting Mara Leverett from her book, Devil's Knot, an incoherent mess.
Couldn't have said it better.
an investigation into the dead boys' families had not produced any information at all. Numerous miscellaneous leads had failed to pan out. The city's still scared to death. People are afraid to go shopping. They think there's a serial killer on the loose.
And there's a couple of things that the police force is working with, and I'll give them some credit on this one, is people are terrified and they are demanding that this gets solved.
That's right.
And that is a pressure cooker.
Yeah, in their haste to solve this crime.
Yes.
3 weeks after the murders, detectives in West Memphis still had not even received the boys' autopsy results from the state crime lab.
Why not?
Backed up.
Was Fahmy Malik there?
No, but I looked to make sure.
Fahmy strikes again.
I looked to make sure. His name did not pop up anywhere in the story, but I was waiting for it to.
God, they were probably on marijuana if Fahmy had done this.
Probably so. So, like you said just now, Kelly, the police were kind of flying blind. They didn't have any specific information, so they've got to come up with something. They've got this blank crime scene. Let's put two and two together, or let's put seven and nine together and try to come up with four here.
Sure.
There was a ton of unanswered questions about the cause of death, the time of death, the exact nature of the boys' injuries. The cops can't know any of this until they get the autopsy results.
Right.
And so into this void, a more or less blind avenue of investigation into an occult connection began to quickly expand. Now, in support of that theory, at least one juvenile probation officer in Crittenden County had been warning police for months that he was finding evidence of occult activity among the troubled teenagers that he was responsible for keeping up with in the West Memphis area.
Okay, now, all right, I'm interested to hear this. What's his evidence?
Back to my hunch is kind of what he says, this juvenile probation officer. He doesn't have... I'll get there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Okay. Early on in this triple murder investigation, this probation officer even thought he had a pretty good idea exactly who did it.
He did. Was it one of his folks?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, this is a month before the murders. I'm sorry. It's a month after the murders.
Okay.
When three teenage boys, the three who would ultimately be convicted of this crime, that's when they were arrested.
Okay.
But it was within just a few days of the crime that detectives began to lean in the direction of the occult, as I have mentioned. Mm-hmm. And a list of possible suspects had been circulating around the law enforcement community in the days after it happened, because this juvenile probation officer wrote down a list of names that he thought might be likely to be involved in this occult thing, since that's the direction the police were going in, and he had seen this evidence, air quotes, of this occult activity among local teenagers.
But did he give it the evidence he was seeing?
Yeah,
okay.
Some of it.
All right.
And so if law enforcement is going to try to sell this devil worship thing, they needed someone to blame it on. Someone specific, somebody weird, somebody strange, because normal people didn't do this in West Memphis or anywhere else. These crazy murders. And it turned out that two of the people that police had already convinced themselves were probably the people they should be looking for were on that list.
Okay.
That the juvenile probation officer had handed over to the cops just days after the murders. One of them was named Damian Eccles.
Okay. Damian, the name working against him.
Yeah. Another was named Jason Baldwin. It would later be determined that it was the juvenile probation officer who put these kids' names on the list of the usual suspects.
Okay. So I don't like that, first and foremost. I know there's a lot of people with this probation officer. You should be better than that. But even if I'm given these names as a detective, my job is not to make them fit this mold.
Exactly.
It is to, okay, this is a lead. I will look into it. But if the evidence doesn't take me there, then I have to leave it be, regardless of what this probation officer says. Because you're a probation officer. You're not a detective. Thanks for the lead. I got it from here.
Right. Yeah, it shouldn't be automatically assumed to be the solution to your problem.
Correct. Correct. And I don't have the autopsies back.
Right.
I'm not a detective, guys, and I know this is what I would do. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I sound so judgy, but...
It's okay.
I think somebody, we could talk...
Somebody out there listening is screaming at their phone or their car radio, wherever they're listening to this. And guys, you're just going to scream louder before it's over.
But I think if we talk to a detective even here in center, they would say, yes, that's what you're going to do. Mm-hmm.
Now, full disclosure about the juvenile probation officer. He had had run-ins already with both Eccles and Baldwin.
Okay.
They were already considered to be troublemakers.
Okay.
They had been in the past, at least.
So he had them on probation. Mm-hmm. They broke the rules. His job is to make sure that they are following the rules set forth by the courts.
That's right.
And so he must react to that. If they're being troublemakers, he has to do what he has to do. So I understand all that. Mm-hmm. It's the rest of it I don't understand.
Yeah. If 18-year-old Damien Eccles, if he was anything, he was a weirdo as far as the people who knew him were concerned. Black hair, black painted fingernails, sharpened to a point. All black wardrobe, boots, black jeans, blank black t-shirt every day.
Yeah.
With a trench coat even in the summertime.
He wasn't likable at all.
To say that he was a troubled teenager would be an understatement.
Yeah. He's actually goth.
He's a goth. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
He had behavioral problems. He'd undergone at least one mental evaluation, reportedly for, among other oddities, telling someone that he was trying to get his girlfriend pregnant so that the baby could be sacrificed in a satanic ritual.
Fun. Mm. He's a fun guy.
Mm-hmm. We begin to understand why the juvenile probation officer had Damien Eccles on his list of possible suspects.
Yeah, he's not helping himself any.
But you know what? At this point, I don't bat an eye at that. I mean, he probably should have.
Sure.
Hey, I've got this kid you may want to look into. He's, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I understand that completely.
Damien Eccles told anyone who bothered to ask that he was a follower of the Wiccan religion.
Good for you, Damien.
He wore a necklace with a pentagram on it. There was a story that he once killed a dog with a knife. Mm. He had the skull of a cat in his room, supposedly. He had licked an injured friend's arm once to taste the blood. Mm.
Yeah,
that was another scary story about Damien Eccles.
Damien needs some mental health.
Damien had been kicked out of school permanently for fighting. He tried to claw somebody's eyes out with those sharpened fingernails of his. He was disagreeable, argumentative, a weirdo.
Yes.
He had once run away from home and sought shelter in an abandoned mobile home during a rainstorm, and that had gotten him arrested for breaking and entering and trespassing, and that was why he had been involved in the juvenile court system.
Yes.
Eccles lived with several other members of his family in a rundown mobile home in a rundown trailer park on the wrong side of the interstate, if not the tracks.
Yeah.
It was called Lakeshore Trailer Park. It was one of the poorest neighborhoods in a county that at the time was, and probably still is, one of the poorest in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I came across the phrase white trash several times as I was researching and finding out more about Damien Eccles.
Mm-hmm. And is that a phrase that's more common in the South, or is it everywhere? Because I mean, when you say white trash around here, we know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I think that's universal.
Is it universal?
I think so.
Okay.
If you're listening today in New Jersey, drop us an email and let us know. TrueCrimeOnEasyStreet@gmail.com.
Yeah, is that a thing?
Every time I've seen like a white trash bash, it's very Talladega looking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
there's a Talladega t-shirt in that costume.
In my mind, it's somewhere. It's Southern.
Yeah. Talladega meaning like the...
The racetrack.
Yeah,
the infield party that happens twice a year at Talladega Super Speedway. The 70,000 people who don't go to the racetrack to watch the race. They just go to have a party that's just where it is that
weekend. It's not all the people there.
No.
And it's certainly not all the folks of Talladega.
That's right. Hey, I'm a huge race fan myself, so I'm not talking about...
No, I know what you mean. I'm just saying...
For the podcast.
But if somebody who's not from Alabama is listening,
you're not.
I wanted to explain that a little bit.
Talladega Super Speedway is not a sponsor, but they could be. If you're listening down there in East Tuboga,
they probably don't need to be. I mean, they don't need any more sponsors. Mm. They're good. They're going to get packed out every time.
Now, this juvenile probation officer that I mentioned, he knew a lot of kids who claimed to be involved in the occult because it meant that they liked to drink and have sex. It was an excuse to do both of those things away from the parents.
Okay.
But Damien, he had been telling people, he's been telling people, hey, Damien Eccles, this kid might be the real deal. He finally killed somebody. That's one quote attributed to this guy.
all of these yeah. things to get attention and doing all these things to call attention to himself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the more this guy talked about Damien, the more the police were willing to listen.
Well, and then they get a look at him and it's like, holy crap.
And this is where, yeah. at that time, Katie asked this question a few minutes ago. At that time in the country, the late 80s, the early 90s, satanic panic was a thing in this country.
Yes.
People believed that playing Dungeons and Dragons and listening to heavy metal music were gateways into what was called the dark world. It was on TV, Phil Donahue, Geraldo Rivera, Maury Povich. They kept housewives entertained for months with stories of satanic panic.
And who was the kid who got arrested and he was wearing the AC/DC t-shirt? It was around this time because AC/DC was really the one that everybody was like, oh, they're really bad.
It was Damien Eccles.
He had the AC/DC.
Actually, Jason Baldwin is the kid who wore the heavy metal t-shirts. Damien wore solid black t-shirts.
Okay. One of them, and I don't know, I didn't even really know it was this case, but had on
Jason Baldwin.
That shirt. Mm-hmm. And then AC/DC's music, you know, there's a lot of songs that reference, you know, they use one at the Alabama ball game every single Saturday. Mm-hmm. They use Hell's Bells.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
I'm a fan of AC/DC.
Well, don't tell anybody in Arkansas.
And I haven't wanted to do anything.
So with all of this like satanic panic, all you needed to do at the time was to convince somebody that somebody who already looked and dressed weirdly was a Satanist was that they wore a Metallica t-shirt or that they painted their hair black or carved their nails or that they had, God forbid, unorthodox religious beliefs. Now, the FBI had conducted a nationwide study in 1991 to determine what all of this hullabaloo was about this satanic panic. And the FBI came away determined that this so-called occult activity was overblown, practically never responsible for any sort of crime at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the panic existed. That was a thing.
Yes.
You could also find people who would claim that Damien Eccles did all of these weird things and acted like a weirdo because he'd been diagnosed as depressed. And that's true. And he simply wanted people to leave him alone. He had social anxiety, and to him,
he found out if I act weird, people will leave me alone.
I don't get beat up at school.
Yeah, they're if I make people afraid of me, then they'll just leave me alone.
That was the best way he knew to accomplish this, was to be a person that nobody wanted to be around. And it almost worked perfectly, except for one person. 16-year-old Jason Baldwin, his family was so poor that they could not even afford to get him a pair of corrective eyeglasses for his horrible nearsightedness. He had to sit in the front of the class to be able to see the chalkboard. I remember when I had to do that before I got glasses. That's embarrassing on top of everything else.
Sure.
Jason had appeared on the juvenile court's radar as a preteen a few years earlier when he and some other kids broke into an old abandoned shed and broke some windows out of an old car that had been sitting inside. But the cops got called. He got arrested, booked and fingerprinted at 12, Jason Baldwin. So even though he was a pretty good student by 1993, he made good grades. He was a smart kid. He was an aspiring artist. He doodled on his notebooks all day, and he was going to go to college and learn commercial art, graphic design. That was his plan. The teachers liked him. The kids liked him. But he had this stain on his record from a few years before, and he was on the radar of the juvenile probation officer.
Okay. He's 16 now, so we're 4 years removed from that.
Yeah.
And he's not done anything else.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, except that he's become friends with Damien Eccles.
Mm.
Jason didn't dress like Damien, but they shared an interest in skateboarding and heavy metal music. To quote Jason Baldwin himself years later, he said, "We stood out because even though we dressed differently, we also dressed differently from everyone else."
Mm-hmm.
Just like my mom, Damien was suffering from depression, and I think our friendship helped him cope.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's commonality there.
Yeah. Probably. And unlike Damien, who practiced Wicca and worshipped a goddess, Jason was a Christian. He believed in God and right and wrong. This is according to Marla Everett in her book.
Mm-hmm.
So Jason definitely did not share Damien's religious interests, but unlike a lot of other people in West Memphis, he tolerated them.
Okay.
Years later, it would be reported that Damien and Jason had become suspects within as few as 4 days after the murder.
Mm.
Based on nothing more than the personal details I have described. and the satanically fueled suspicions of one juvenile probation officer and a few detectives from the West Memphis Police Department.
I'm just not, I guess Jason Baldwin got brought into it because he was friends with.
That's right.
I just don't know. I mean, understand why that juvenile probation officer would have put his name on that list from the thing at 12. Mm-hmm.
Because he's friends with.
It had to have been.
He's friends with lead troublemaker Damien Eccles.
Friends. It's like Damien and his friends.
If he did it, then he must have been involved because they're always together.
Yeah.
That's it. Guilt by association.
Yeah. Yeah. The company you keep, huh?
And now it's time to introduce our listeners to the third member.
Okay.
Of the West Memphis Three.
I've been waiting. I've been counting, thinking, are we?
Yeah. Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. Mm-hmm. He had a pretty big reputation for such a little guy by the time he was 17 years old. He had been a playground fighter since kindergarten. He was the fourth youngest of nine now motherless siblings. Mom left a long time ago. So his public displays of violence were perhaps attributable to his broken and crowded home life. According to Mara Leverett, Jesse's most persistent memory from childhood consisted of, quote, fighting all the time.
Very volatile home life.
And Jesse was not the smartest kid in his class, to say the least. At age seven, he had scored 67 on a school-administered IQ test. To borrow a phrase from the time, he was considered mildly mentally retarded.
Yeah.
A psychologist who once...
Assessed,
Jesse Miss Kelly, said that he needed to be treated in a hospital for his behavioral problems. But the family... The Miss Kelly family was just as dirt poor as the Eccles and Baldwin families, and so that treatment was never administered.
When you have a kid who grows up in an environment where there's a lot of fighting and volatile, you know, he's got the low IQ working against him.
Yeah.
But then you take his environment. That will chemically alter a child's brain because certain chemicals are released when you are in that turmoil constantly.
Yeah.
Stressed
right,
out
right.
as a child, yeah. It will change your brain and it will make you a behavioral problem. So he had both of those things working against him.
At age 11, Jesse was still in the third grade.
Yeah.
Also by that time, he had already hit a girl in the head, stabbed a boy with a pencil and severely injured his hand trying to punch out the windows of parked cars.
I agree with the psychologist. He needed to be inpatient for them to figure out what was going on.
At the time of the murders at Robin Hood Hills, Jesse had been a high school dropout for over a year already. He had a tattoo on his right arm that read FTW, fuck the world. On his left arm was a skull with a dagger piercing it, and on his chest, the word bitch.
FTW means for the win now, so he would have, don't get just dumb tattoos, kids.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Be careful.
On the morning of June the 3rd, it was a Thursday, 1993, almost an entire month after the murders had taken place, Jesse was picked up at his home in a West Memphis trailer park, another West Memphis trailer park, by a detective who said that he just wanted to take him downtown and ask him a few questions about his friends Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin.
Oh, mm-hmm. And did he hang out with them?
He had known Damien for about a year. He and Jason had been friends since they were 12 years old. Well, since Jason was 12 years old.
Okay.
So they've been friends for five years.
Okay.
And Jason ran around with Damien, so by association, he too spent time in Damien's company. Although those two never really liked each other that much. Damien thought Jesse was an idiot, which he was. Oh. And I'm sorry.
I understand.
And Jesse thought that Damien was weird, which he was.
Yeah.
So the reason that the cops want to talk to Jesse, like I said, they know that he knows these guys, and we don't know this yet, but they're on the top of the they did it list that has two names on it. Jesse said later that the detective who drove him to the police station told him that he just wanted to ask him a few questions, and he did remember to mention that there was a $35,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in the murders. Wow, your dad could buy himself a new pickup truck with that money, the police officer said to Jesse.
He's literally preying on a poor kid.
Yeah. Before the interview began, Jesse was asked to sign a form waiving his Miranda rights. Having never mastered cursive script, Jesse Miss Kelly was forced to print his name on the form. He did not have a signature. He didn't know what that was. By this time, his IQ is about 70. He had to print his name on the form.
So is everybody remembers the movie Forrest Gump, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Was Forrest about a 70?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just to give you some context.
Yeah. After initially denying that he was a member of a cult or knew anything in the world about the murders at Robin Hood Hills, Jesse was asked to take a polygraph test, which he did.
I don't agree.
Never take a polygraph test. It can only hurt you.
Yeah,
because they can't use it as evidence against you anyway.
Nope.
So after the polygraph test, the cop rushes into the room and says, "You're lying your ass off. I've got the proof right here in my hand." And Jesse, in his diminished intellectual capacity, immediately began telling the officers what they wanted to hear so that they would stop shouting at him, he said later, "because I just wanted to go home."
Oh. How are they able to question him without a guardian?
Because they went to the McDonald's in town and found Jesse Miss Kelly Sr. and got him to sign the form allowing the polygraph test to be administered.
Why did
and
he?
Because he thinks, my kid's got nothing to hide. He had an alibi. He was not even in town that night.
But he knows the mental capacity of his son.
I don't know how much smarter Sr. is than Junior.
Okay.
Yeah, that's gotta be it.
We talked about this before we went on the air, Kelly. We have not yet tackled the story about that led to the creation of the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer. But if you are familiar with that story, then everything that I just told you about Jesse Miss Kelly Jr.'s jailhouse confession is going to sound hauntingly familiar.
Yes, yeah. If you've seen that. If you've seen those tapes.
Jesse said later, "I just repeated what they told me." This was his attempt to explain the 34-minute audio tape. That was the portion of his 11-hour interrogation that was recorded for posterity on audio tape.
Are
he was there for 11
me?
Hours. They recorded the last 34 minutes. He said, "I had to go through every one of their stories until I got it right so they would stop yelling at me. So whatever they were telling me, I started telling them back. I figured they knew I was lying because they were lying too." That's what Jesse said.
Am I
giving this away with my voice
yet?
That
sounds just like something that a younger child would say, because mm-hmm. that's kind of his
yeah.
mentality.
Yeah. Following Jesse's day-long interview, at last, a month after the murders, the West Memphis police finally had a piece of evidence that might help them solve this crime, a confession. They still didn't have any physical evidence. They didn't have a murder weapon. They didn't even have much of a motive at all, but they had a confession. Regarding that confession, basically every time Jesse told the police something that was not accurate about the murders or about Damien or about Jason, the investigators led him around by the nose until he spat out the information that fit their by now predominant theory of an outlandish motive for the murders of a satanic sacrifice committed by Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin as Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. stood there and watched.
Oh,
it sounds hard to believe.
Sounds like a bad movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, they made one, and it was bad. But that's going to be the argument from the prosecution that Jesse's court-appointed defense attorney is going to make when this gets to trial. That Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. was a simpleton who simply said what he thought the angry policeman in that interrogation room wanted to hear. And that argument is not going to go well for 17-year-old Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. or 18-year-old Damien Echols or 16-year-old Jason Baldwin, all of whom would be tried as adults.
Yeah. Because the crime is so brutal.
In the state of Arkansas.
Yeah.
In early 1994, each for 3 counts of capital murder, but you're going to have to come back next week for part 2 if you want to hear what happened in that courtroom next week.
Thank you so much, Scott. This is a difficult story, and you're doing a great job with it. Give us a follow on Facebook, mm-hmm. Instagram. Send us an email if you want to tell us a case that yeah. you would like us to look into.
Or confirm our theory about the phrase white trash.
The white trash phrase, yeah. Thank you for joining us today, and we will see you next week.
Is that it? Are we done?
We're done.
Good night, everybody.